So, before we jump in, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. They've got a full Series 99 course with, adaptive study quizzes and smart flashcards, plus unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing.
Yeah, that waiting is huge.
Yeah, it really is. So, check it out at CERTFuel.com. Anyway, let's imagine a scenario for a second here.
Okay.
So you got an intern at a major Wall Street broker-dealer.
Right.
And he's carrying a tray of iced coffees. He trips. The coffee spills right into a server rack.
Oh no.
Yeah, a few lines of code short circuit. And suddenly a daily financial calculation gets, slightly
That's
scrambled.
a little bit off, yeah.
Right. Now, in most businesses, that is, well, it's just an IT headache.
Yeah, you just buy a new server and move on.
Exactly. But in the world of broker-dealers, that single IT headache could trigger a federal regulatory violation. It could freeze millions of dollars of customer assets,
Oh yeah.
and it could literally end a senior executive's career.
Totally. It happens.
So today, our mission is to understand the tripwires that make that reality possible. We are mastering the regulatory financial requirements for the Series 99 exam.
The big one.
The big one. If you are prepping for this test, you probably already know function one makes up a staggering 70% of your exam.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's the absolute bedrock of the Series 99.
Right.
The exam writers are essentially testing whether you understand how a financial firm keeps itself alive
Yeah.
and, well, more importantly, how it keeps its customers safe. But
Exactly.
the way this material is presented in, like, standard textbooks, it's notoriously difficult to parse.
It's awful.
It's so dense, it's highly technical, and it is just full of these interlocking ratios.
Which is exactly why we are setting some ground rules for our discussion today.
Okay, lay them out.
So we are not doing a dry monotone read-through of the regulation.
Thank goodness.
Right? Because if you are anything like me, a standard lecture is going to put you right to sleep.
Oh, absolutely.
And we need this information to actually stick in your brain for test day. So we are going to use some highly specific, occasionally kind of absurd examples.
I love that.
Yeah, we have a whole cast of alliterative recurring characters to help us map out how these rules actually play out in the real world.
It helps so much to visualize it.
It really does. And we are going to explicitly flag the exam traps, the sneaky, counterintuitive questions the test writers just love to throw at you.
I think that is, well, it's the only way to tackle this effectively,
Yeah.
because when you merely try to memorize a page of SEC rules, you are fighting a losing battle against your own memory.
Right, it's just alphabet soup.
Exactly. But if you can internalize the underlying logic, like if you can understand the philosophy behind why a rule exists, who it's designed to protect, and, the mechanical consequences of violating it.
You stop memorizing and start deducing.
Yes. You can face a multiple choice question you have never seen before in your life and reason your way to the correct answer.
So let's start with the foundation of everything.
Let's do it.
Because before a firm can submit any kind of official paperwork to the regulators, they have to know what money is actually in the building.
Right. Yeah.
We are talking about the general ledger. Now, when I was reviewing the source material on this, the best analogy I could come up with for the general ledger is a teenager's highly detailed, slightly neurotic financial diary.
Oh, that's really good, right?
Imagine a kid who writes down literally every single penny they earn from mowing a lawn.
Yeah.
Every dollar they spend on a video game, the $5 they owe their sister,
Right.
all meticulously, just obsessively logged day by day.
It is an apt comparison because the defining characteristic of a general ledger is its raw, granular detail.
Pick everything.
It's everything. The general ledger is the broker-dealer's central accounting record. It is the destination where all the daily financial transactions, the cash receipts, the disbursements, the account balances, they are ultimately organized there.
Okay.
It is basically the internal circulatory system of the firm's accounting.
But I want to push back on the regulatory necessity of this for a second.
Okay, push back.
If this ledger contains literally every piece of financial data, why don't broker dealers just package up the ledger, throw it in an envelope, mail it to the Securities and Exchange Commission, and say, hey, here is our math. Check it if you want.
Right.
Like, why do we need an entirely separate tier of regulatory reports if we have this master diary?
Well, because mailing a raw general ledger to a regulator would be like, Handing a health inspector a pile of grocery store receipts and asking them to taste a cake you haven't baked yet?
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Right. The SEC does not have the manpower nor the desire, frankly, to sift through millions of raw internal data points to figure out if a firm is solvent.
They go crazy.
They would. The general ledger is the underlying accounting source. It is the raw data. It is an internal document.
Right.
Now, it must be utterly current and perfectly complete because every single piece of regulatory math you do depends on it.
Like the coffee spill.
Exactly like the coffee spill. If your ledger is corrupted, your regulatory calculations are compromised.
Got it.
But the ledger itself is not formatted for regulatory surveillance.
Okay, that right there feels like a massive trap for the exam.
Oh, it is.
If I'm sitting for the Series 99 and a multiple choice question asks me what document a broker dealer submits to the SEC to demonstrate financial compliance, one of the choices is absolutely going to be the general ledger.
Without a doubt. It is one of the most common distractors they use.
Sneaky.
Yeah, the test raters know that when you study this material, the words ledger and report, they start to blur together.
Yeah, they really do.
You have to keep them strictly separated in your mind.
Right.
The general ledger supports the regulatory reporting, but it is never a substitute for it.
Okay, I use a really simple mnemonic trick to keep this straight.
Let's hear it.
Ledger equals local. They both start with L.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, the ledger is your local, internal, messy accounting diary. It stays in the house. So, if the general ledger is the raw data that stays in the house, what is the polished document that actually gets sent out the door? Like, if the ledger is the teenager's diary, the document we're about to talk about is the formal report card you hand over to your very strict parents.
And those strict parents are the commission.
Right.
The document you are referring to is the FOCS report.
OCS.
Yeah, FOCS is an acronym for Financial and Operational Combined Uniform Single Report.
That's a mouthful.
It is. And if you want the technical form number, it is Form X-17A5.
Form X-17A5. It honestly sounds like a classified military aircraft.
Well, it carries about as much weight in the compliance world, honestly.
Yeah.
The OCS report is the broker-dealer's primary regulatory reporting vehicle.
Okay.
It takes all of that chaotic, granular data from the general ledger, it filters it through a highly standardized set of rules, and it communicates the firm's official statement of financial condition to the regulators.
Okay, so it cleans it up.
Exactly. It cleans it up. And it also includes all the required regulatory computations, which we will get into later.
Let's ground this in a real world scenario. I want to introduce the first of our recurring characters today.
Okay, who do we have?
Let's call him Clueless Colin.
Clueless Colin. Nice.
Yeah, Colin is a retail investor.
Yeah.
He is a perfectly nice guy. He makes a decent living, but he has absolutely no idea how the plumbing of Wall Street works.
Very common.
Super common. So a few months ago, Colin bought 50 shares of Apple stock through his broker dealer.
Okay.
Now, let's say it's the end of the quarter, and Colin wants to know exactly how his specific Apple investment is performing. Okay, pause right here for a beat. Listeners, think about this. Would Colin ever call up his broker and say, excuse me, could you please mail me a copy of the firm's FOCS report so I can check my Apple stock?
Oh, man.
Just take a beat. No, he absolutely would not.
If he did, his broker would probably be very, very confused.
Yeah, they'd hang up on him.
Right. No, Colin would never ask for a FOCS report. And a FOCS report would be entirely useless to him anyway.
Why is that?
Well, if Colin wants to see his Apple shares, he needs his individual customer account statement.
Ah.
And this highlights a critical distinction you just must understand for the exam. It's the difference between firm-level reporting and customer-level reporting.
Okay, break that down for us side by side.
Sure. So the FOCS report operates entirely at the macro, firm-wide level.
Right.
It provides the regulators with a snapshot of the broker-dealer's overall financial health, you know, its aggregated assets, its liabilities, and its capital compliance.
All the big numbers.
All the big numbers. It doesn't break down the fact that Clueless Colin owns 50 shares of Apple.
Okay.
The customer account statement, on the other hand, is a micro-level document.
Right.
It is tailored specifically to Colin. It shows him his personal positions, his cash balances, and his recent transaction history.
I can already see the exam crap here.
It's a big one.
Yeah, the test writers are going to try to blur the lines between these two obligations. Let me throw a hypothetical at you.
Let's hear it.
Let's say a broker-dealer is running a perfectly tight ship.
Okay.
Their general ledger is flawless. They compiled their FOCS report, Form X-17A5. Mm. They submitted to the SEC early. The math is impeccable. And the regulators are just thrilled.
A compliance officer's dream.
Exactly. The firm is in perfect financial health.
Yeah.
Can that firm turn around and say, well, we proved to the government that our math is perfect, so we don't need to bother mailing out the individual customer account statements this month?
Absolutely not.
Right.
And that is exactly how the exam will try to trick you. Firm-level compliance does not absolve you of customer-level obligations.
They're totally separate.
They serve two entirely different legal purposes. The Focus report proves to the SEC that the firm is solvent enough to stay in business.
Yeah.
The account statement proves to clueless Colin that the firm hasn't lost his Apple stock. You can be perfectly compliant on your firm-level Focus report and still commit a massive regulatory violation by failing to deliver individual customer statements.
Okay, so we have the internal diary, which is the general ledger.
Yeah.
We have the external report card, the FOCI US report.
Correct.
And we have the customer's personal receipt, which is the account statement.
You got it.
Now, this is a mountain of math and compliance. Who is the actual human being sweating over these spreadsheets?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because earlier we talked about the SEC not wanting to sift through raw data. They want accountability.
They want a person.
They want a person. So who is the person legally on the hook if the numbers are wrong?
That brings us to one of the most important roles in any broker-dealer, which is the financial and operations principal.
Which gives us our second character for the day.
Let's introduce Fiona the Finock.
Fiona the Finock, I like her already. Yeah, I picture Fiona sitting in a corner office with like three oversized monitors, a massive thermos of black coffee, and just the entire regulatory weight of the broker-dealer resting squarely on her shoulders.
That is actually a highly accurate visualization.
Yeah.
Yeah, the FinOp is the designated principal responsible for the firm's financial and operational compliance.
Mm, yeah.
Fiona is not a salesperson. She is the operational anchor.
Right.
Her core responsibilities are vast and incredibly serious. Like, she has the final, ultimate responsibility for preparing and approving all of those regulatory financial reports we just talked about, including the FOCI US report.
Wow. Final responsibility.
Final. She also supervises the personnel who maintain the source books, meaning, you know, the people updating that general ledger.
Okay, I want to test the limits of Fiona's liability here.
Go for it.
Let's go back to the scenario I mentioned at the very beginning of the show. We have an intern working in the back office. Let's call him Intern Iggy.
Okay, poor Iggy.
Poor Iggy. Iggy trips, spills his iced coffee on the server rack, and completely ruins the data poll for the quarter.
It happened.
The numbers get scrambled. And because the numbers are scrambled, the FOCI risk report is generated with just disastrously inaccurate math, and it gets submitted to the SEC.
Oh, boy.
The regulators catch the error, and they come knocking on the door with fines and sanctions. Now, can Fiona the FinOp point her finger at Intern Iggy and say, look, I know my name is on the form, but the kid tripped. It's his fault. Go find the intern.
She can point her finger all she wants, but the regulators will ignore Intern Iggy completely and they will sanction Fiona.
Really?
Yes. This goes to the very core of why the FinOp role exists in the first place. The regulatory framework is designed around a concept of ultimate accountability.
Right.
Regulators need a single, qualified, registered individual who assumes liability for the firm's financial reporting. They need one neck to wring.
One neck to wring. That is brutal, but I will definitely remember it for the exam.
It is the reality of the role. Fiona has final responsibility for the accuracy of the reports. Right.
And the key word there is supervises. She supervises the back office personnel.
Ah, I see.
If Intern Iggy was in a position where a spilled coffee could compromise a federal regulatory filing without being caught by secondary checks or redundancies, then Fiona's supervisory system failed.
It's a systemic failure.
Exactly. In the eyes of the commission, the error on the FOCI USA report is Fiona's error, regardless of who physically spilled the drink.
Wow. Okay, this highlights a couple of really common exam traps regarding the FinOp.
Let's go through them.
If the FinOp is operating at this high-stakes, firm-wide level, how does the exam try to confuse candidates about her day-to-day job?
Well, the first trap is scope.
Okay.
The exam will often present a multiple-choice option, suggesting that the FinOp is responsible for servicing specific customer accounts.
Hmm.
Like, they might frame it as Fiona personally calling up clueless Colin to resolve a margin call on his Apple stock.
And that's false, right? Because she's macro, not micro. entirely false. Fiona operates at the firm level. She is monitoring the macro financial health and the aggregated regulatory computations of the entire broker-dealer.
Right.
She is not acting as a retail broker, managing individual portfolios, or, you know, chatting with clients about their daily trades.
There's a second trap here that I find much sneakier.
Which one?
The source material outlines Fiona's duties, and it specifically mentions two massive calculations. It says net capital work and reserve formula work.
What?
And the exam apparently loves to present these two tasks as a sequential workflow. Like, Fiona calculates the net capital and then takes that number and plugs it into the reserve formula to get her final answer.
Yeah, that is a classic trap designed to catch people who have skimmed the material but haven't actually digested the concepts.
So they're not connected like that?
Not at all. Net capital and the reserve formula are completely separate duties. They're not stages in a linear step-by-step workflow. Right. They are distinct parallel calculations that serve entirely different regulatory purposes. Fiona oversees both of them, yes, but they are not the same equation.
Which is the perfect transition.
I think I hear a gong.
Buzzer noise. Math alert. Yeah, we just dropped the terms net capital and reserve formula, and honestly, this is where the Series 99 exam gets really heavy.
It does.
This is where the math happens.
Yeah.
So let's shift gears and dive deeply into these two concepts, which the material refers to as the twin pillars of financial responsibility.
We need to take these one at a time because the philosophy behind each pillar is completely different.
Let's do it.
Let's start with the first pillar, which is net capital. The simplest way to understand net capital is to think of it as the firm's survival padding.
Survival padding. I really like that.
It helps, right? Net capital measures the broker-dealer's regulatory financial resources. It asks a fundamental question. If the market crashes tomorrow and this firm's business model completely implodes, does the firm have enough liquid capital on hand to safely unwind its operations, pay its debts, and shut down without causing a systemic panic across the rest of Wall Street?
So it's essentially the SEC demanding that you prove you aren't living paycheck to paycheck as a business.
Exactly.
You have to prove you have a liquid safety net. And to prove that, there are two distinct standards a firm might use to calculate this. Let's break down the first one. It's the aggregate indebtedness standard.
Yeah.
Under this rule, a firm's indebtedness generally cannot exceed 1,500% of its net capital.
Okay, hold that number.
But if the firm is in its first 12 months of operating, that ceiling drops to 800%.
Yes.
Now, why the massive difference for a new firm?
Because a new firm is inherently riskier.
Makes sense.
They don't have a track record of operational stability. The SEC looks at a firm in its first year and says, well, we don't trust your business model yet, so we are going to restrict how much debt you can take on relative to your capital.
They put training wheels on them.
Exactly. Now, there is a critical nuance here that you must circle, highlight, and underline in your study notes.
Listeners, perk up.
The exam will frequently try to phrase these numbers, the 1,500% and 800%, as minimum requirements.
Right. They'll say something like, a broker-dealer must maintain a minimum indebtedness of 1,500%, which honestly sounds kind of plausible if you're rushing through the test.
It sounds plausible, but it is completely backward.
Yeah.
1,500% and 800% are maximum ratios.
Maximum.
They represent a ceiling on how leveraged the firm can be. You're allowed to have zero indebtedness. The regulators would love it if you had zero debt.
True.
But your debt cannot exceed 15 times your net capital or 8 times if you are a new firm.
Okay, so that's the ratio side of things under the aggregate indebtedness standard. There's also the alternative standard, where a firm must maintain the greater of $250,000 or 2% of aggregate debit items.
Right, that's the alternative path.
But beyond the ratios, there is a whole tiered system of minimum dollar amounts that a firm must maintain, and it depends entirely on what the firm actually does.
This is where it gets tricky.
Yeah, this is an area where rote memorization is somewhat unavoidable, but let's try to map it logically so the listener doesn't just have to stare at flashcards all day.
Let's do it. The logic here is risk-based scaling.
Okay.
The amount of minimum liquid capital a firm is required to hold scales proportionally with the amount of risk that firm poses to the public and to customer assets.
Let's build this out tier by tier. The top tier, the heaviest requirement, is $250,000.
Yep.
Why would a firm need $250,000 in minimum net capital?
A firm hits the $250,000 requirement if they carry accounts and actually receive or hold customer funds or securities.
So they have the physical cash.
Exactly. This means they physically possess the customer's assets. If this firm goes bankrupt, the customer's actual money is trapped inside the burning building.
Right.
Because they're holding the bag of cash, they represent the highest level of risk to the consumer, so the SEC demands the highest level of survival padding.
That makes perfect sense. Custody equals maximum risk.
Oh, I see.
Precisely.
Okay, the next tier down is $100,000. This applies to a specified exempt broker-dealer or a dealer. Moving down again, we hit $50,000.
This is a good one to understand.
Yes, an interesting one. This applies to a fully disclosed introducing firm. They might receive customer securities, but they don't hold them.
Right.
Why such a massive drop from $250,000 to $50,000 just for being introducing?
Because the nature of the risk has fundamentally changed.
Oh, so?
An introducing firm operates essentially as a middleman.
Yeah.
They find the client, they give the advice, and they might even take a check from the client. But they don't deposit that check into their own vault.
Oh, they pass it along. They immediately forward that money to a larger carrying firm that actually holds the assets.
I see.
Because the introducing firm isn't acting as the ultimate custodian, the systemic risk if they go out of business is much lower.
Because the money isn't there.
Right. Their client's money is safely parked at the larger firm. Therefore, their capital requirement drops significantly.
We'll actually talk a lot more about that relationship between introducing firms and carrying firms in just a minute, because that's a whole section of the exam on its own.
It really is.
Let's finish the tiers first. Below the $50,000 level, we have $25,000. This is for firms engaging in specified registered investment company or insurance separate account activity.
Yep.
And finally, the lowest tier, which is $5,000. Who gets away with only holding $5,000 in capital?
The absolute lowest risk operators.
Like who?
Well, a $5,000 firm does not receive customer funds. They do not hold customer funds. They do not owe funds. They do not carry accounts.
So they basically don't touch money.
Exactly. They might be a boutique mergers and acquisitions advisory shop that simply consults on corporate deals but never actually touches anyone's cash or stock certificates.
Gotcha.
Low risk to the public requires the lowest minimum capital.
Now, here is where the exam loves to lay a trap.
Oh, yeah. They love this one.
What happens when a firm decides to diversify?
Okay.
Let's say we have a firm that spends 95% of its time doing that low risk $5,000 M&A consulting.
Super safe.
Super safe. But occasionally, maybe once or twice a year, they hold some customer funds to facilitate a special transaction, which is a $250,000 activity.
Okay.
When Fiona the FinOp calculates their requirement, does she get to blend it? Like, can she say, well, we're mostly a $5,000 firm, so let's call the requirement $10,000?
She absolutely cannot.
Really?
No. And the exam will test you on this exact concept. In the regulatory world, if a firm engages in multiple types of activities, the applicable minimum net capital requirement is always the greatest one that applies.
The greatest one.
It does not matter if the high-risk activity makes up 1% of your revenue. The moment you touch the high-risk wire, you pay the high-risk toll.
Wow.
If you hold funds even once, you must maintain $250,000 in net capital at all times.
The highest applicable requirement.
Yeah.
Listeners, lock that in your memory.
Do not forget that.
So that is the first pillar, net capital. It's the firm's survival padding, designed to make sure the broker-dealer itself doesn't collapse.
Right.
But now we need to look at the second pillar, which is the reserve formula. This is also known as the customer protection rule. And you mentioned earlier that the philosophy here is totally different.
It is entirely different.
How so?
Well, if net capital is about protecting the broker-dealer from going bankrupt, the reserve formula is about protecting the customer's money from the broker-dealer.
I want to explore that because I think a lot of people assume that when they give a broker-dealer their money, it just sits in a little virtual cubby with their name on it.
A lot of people think that, yeah.
But that's not how the plumbing works, is it? Broker-dealers are businesses. They have operating expenses. They engage in their own proprietary trading.
Right.
How does the SEC prevent a firm from just using Clueless Collins' uninvested cash to pay the firm's electric bill, or worse, to make risky bets in the market?
They prevent it through the reserve formula.
Okay.
This is a strict mathematical calculation that acts as a firewall between the customer's assets and the firm's business operations.
Let's bring Fiona the Fino back into the room.
Okay, she's back at her desk.
It's Friday afternoon. She is staring at her monitors, and she is crunching the numbers for the reserve formula calculation. At its core, this calculation requires Fiona to compare two massive data points.
Right.
Total customer credits against total customer debits.
Mm-hmm.
Walk us through what those terms actually mean in plain English.
Sure. In the simplest terms, customer credits represent the money the broker-dealer owes to the customers.
Okay.
If Clueless Colin sells his Apple stock and leaves the cash sitting in his brokerage account, that cash is a credit. The firm owes him that money.
So credits mean the firm owes the client.
Exactly. Customer debits, on the other hand, represent money the customers owe to the firm.
Like what?
For example, if a customer borrows money on margin to buy stock, that is a debit. The customer owes the firm.
Okay, so Fiona compares the credits, what the firm owes customers, against the debits, what customers owe the firm.
Yep.
Now, let's play out the scenario. I'm going to ask you, the listener, a direct question here.
Get ready.
Fiona finishes her math, and she discovers that total customer credits exceed total customer debits.
Okay.
Meaning, broadly speaking, the firm holds more customer cash than the customers owe the firm. What is Fiona's immediate regulatory obligation? Give it a second. Okay, what must she do?
She cannot let that excess cash sit in the firm's general checking account.
Not at all.
If total credits exceed total debits, the exact amount of that net excess must be taken out of the firm's operational flow and deposited into a special reserve bank account for the exclusive benefit of customers.
So it's literally locking the cash in a vault.
Essentially, yes. It is a segregated bank account.
Wow.
The broker-dealer cannot use the money in that reserve account to pay salaries. They cannot use it to fund their own trading. And crucially, if the broker-dealer goes bankrupt tomorrow morning, the firm's creditors cannot touch the money in that reserve account.
That's the firewall.
That's the firewall. It is walled off to ensure that the customers can be made whole.
This is why I love looking at these concepts side by side.
Yeah, it clarifies things.
Net capital is the firm saying, we have enough of our own money to survive. The reserve formula
Yeah.
is the firm saying, we have taken the customer's money and locked it away so we can't accidentally spend it.
Exactly right.
They are twin pillars of financial responsibility, but they do completely different jobs.
Exactly. And to reiterate the trap we discussed earlier regarding Fiona, you can see why these are completely distinct calculations.
Yeah.
One evaluates the firm's total leverage and liquidity. The other is a specific reconciliation of customer cash balances. They are parallel processes, not sequential steps.
Now, as we're talking through this, I'm putting myself in the shoes of someone who wants to start a financial advisory business.
Okay.
We just established that if I want to hold customer funds, I have to maintain a massive $250,000 in liquid net capital.
A lot of money.
And I have to have someone like Fiona constantly running these complex reserve formulas to segregate cash.
Yeah.
That sounds incredibly expensive and like a massive operational headache.
It is. It's a huge barrier to entry.
So what if I just want to be a great salesman? What if I want to find clients, talk strategy, and give advice, but I want absolutely nothing to do with the liability of holding their cash or doing reserve math?
That is an incredibly common sentiment in the
I
industry,
bet.
and it is the exact reason why carrying agreements exist.
Which brings us to the final major topic of our deep dive today and introduces our third character.
Here we go.
Let's be introducing Ian.
Introducing Ian.
Yeah, Ian runs a small, scrappy broker-dealer. Ian is phenomenal at sales. He takes clients to dinner. He talks market strategy. He builds trust.
He's a people person.
Totally. But Ian despises compliance paperwork. He doesn't want to hire a massive back office staff, and he definitely doesn't have $250,000 sitting around to meet the net capital requirement for holding funds.
No way.
So Ian looks for a workaround. He decides to sign a carrying agreement with a massive Wall Street mega firm.
A carrying agreement is fundamentally a responsibility map.
Okay, explain that.
It is a formal written contract between an introducing firm like Ian's and a massive carrying firm, also known as a clearing firm.
Okay.
This contract explicitly identifies which firm handles which operational functions for the customer accounts. It draws the boundary lines of regulatory liability.
Now, there are very specific rules about how this map can be drawn, particularly for accounts carried on a fully disclosed basis.
Yes.
And fully disclosed basically means the massive carrying firm knows exactly who Clueless Colin is, right?
Yeah.
Ian isn't hiding the customer's identity.
Right. The carrying firm has all of Colin's info.
For these fully disclosed accounts, the source material states that the massive carrying firm must keep the responsibility for certain major functions. Let's break those down. First, the carrying firm must maintain the responsibility for safeguarding funds and securities.
Which solves Ian's primary problem.
Right.
By allocating the safeguarding of assets to the carrying firm, Ian no longer holds customer funds. Because he doesn't hold the funds, his net capital requirement drops from $250,000 down to $50,000.
That's a huge relief for him.
Exactly. The caring firm, which already maintains the massive $250,000 capital requirement and the complex reserve formula infrastructure, they assume the risk of custody.
That part makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah.
But there's a second major responsibility the caring firm must retain, which is preparing and transmitting account statements.
This is where it gets interesting.
This is where the rules get really granular,
yeah.
Where I want to push back on how liability actually works.
Let's do it.
The material says the carrying firm can authorize introducing Ian to physically print and mail the statements on their behalf. But, and this feels like a contradiction, the carrying firm still holds the regulatory responsibility for those statements.
It is not a contradiction, I promise. It is the cornerstone of regulatory outsourcing.
But wait, think about this logically.
Okay.
Ian wants his branding on the statements. He wants Clueless Colin to feel like he's dealing with Ian's boutique firm, not some faceless Wall Street behemoth.
Sure.
So the carrying firm says, fine, Ian, we will transmit the data to you, and you can print the statements on your fancy letterhead and mail them out.
Right.
But let's say Ian forgets to buy stamps. The statements never go out. Clueless Colin complains to the SEC. Does the SEC fine Ian, or do they fine the massive carrying firm?
They fine the massive carrying firm.
What?
Yep. And the carrying firm cannot point to the contract and say, look, we authorized Ian to do the mailing. It's his fault.
Why not? They literally agreed that Ian would do it. It's in the contract.
Because of a fundamental regulatory doctrine you must memorize for the Series 99, allocation of a task does not eliminate accountability.
Uh-oh.
You can outsource the labor. You can outsource the physical printing, the envelope stuffing, and the stamps, but you cannot outsource the regulatory liability.
So the carrying firm is still on the hook.
Always. When the carrying firm signs the agreement, they accept the legal burden of ensuring those statements are transmitted. If Ian fails to physically do it, the carrying firm has failed in their regulatory duty to oversee the process they outsourced.
You can outsource the labor, but you cannot outsource the liability. I want every listener to pause and write that phrase down right now.
Put it on a flashcard.
That is an absolute golden rule for the exam. The carrying firm's responsibility is never eliminated simply because another firm performed the physical function.
Exactly. The SEC ensures that the entity with the deepest pockets and the most robust compliance infrastructure, which is the carrying firm, remains ultimately accountable to the customer.
Let's look at this from the customer's perspective. Clueless Colin opened his account with introducing Ian. Shortly after, Colin receives a formal written notice in the mail.
Yep.
This notice explains that his account is fully disclosed and that a carrying agreement exists between Ian and the massive Wall Street firm.
Right.
Here is a question for the listeners. If Colin reads this document, does this notice serve as a promise that introducing Ian will personally perform specific physical tasks for his account? Like, is the notice guaranteeing Colin that Ian will be the one executing his trades or licking his envelopes? Pause for a second. Think about it.
No, it makes no such promises regarding physical performance.
Right.
The notice provided to the customer is purely about the allocation of responsibility, not the delegation of tasks.
Okay.
It simply informs Colin that the agreement exists, and it maps out which firm holds the regulatory liability for different aspects of his account.
So it's basically saying, here's who to sue.
Essentially, yes. It tells Colin, if your money goes missing, you hold the carrying firm responsible. It is a transparency document, not a job description.
A map of responsibility. That is the perfect way to summarize carrying agreements. I think we have successfully navigated the deepest, most complex traps in Function 1.
We covered a lot of ground.
We really did. We've gone from the raw data of the ledger all the way to how firms divvy up the legal liability. Now, to lock this in, we aren't just going to repeat a list of definitions.
Good.
Let's do a rapid-fire recap, but I want to try something different. Let's trace a single hypothetical error all the way through the ecosystem we just built.
Oh, I love this idea.
Let's see the butterfly effect of how interconnected these financial regulations truly are.
I think an interconnected scenario is the best way to synthesize everything we've covered. Where does the error start?
The error starts at the very beginning. Let's go back to the general ledger.
Okay, back to the diary.
Right. It's Tuesday morning. Introducing Ian has just convinced Clueless Colin to deposit $100,000 into his account.
Nice sale, Ian.
Ian forwards the money to the massive carrying firm. At the carrying firm, intern Iggy is entering data into the general ledger.
Oh no, Iggy.
Iggy makes a typo. he accidentally logs Colin's $100,000 deposit as a $1,000 deposit.
Gosh.
Couple of zeros just get dropped. What happens next?
Well, because the general ledger is the underlying accounting source, that corrupted data immediately infects the firm's internal math. The ledger is no longer utterly current or complete.
Right. And then the end of the month arrives. It's time to file the regulatory reports.
The firm's automated systems pull that flawed data from the general ledger to construct the FOCIUS report, Form X17A5.
The report card.
Exactly. Remember, the FOCIUS report packages the raw data into the firm's statement of financial condition. Because the ledger is short by $99,000, the FOCIUS report submitted to the SEC now drastically underreports the firm's assets and liabilities.
So the firm has just submitted inaccurate firm-level regulatory data.
They have. It's a huge violation.
Meanwhile, Fiona the FENOP is sitting in her office, completely unaware of the typo, and she's running her twin pillars of financial responsibility. She starts with net capital.
Fiona relies on the same corrupted data pool. She calculates the firm's net capital, its survival padding.
Right.
Because the firm's assets are artificially understated due to Iggy's typo, Fiona might erroneously conclude that the firm has breached its 1,500% aggregate indebtedness maximum, or that it has fallen below its required $250,000 minimum.
Oh, wow. So it sets off false alarms.
Exactly. She might trigger a massive internal panic over a capital deficiency that doesn't actually exist, or worse, the flawed data might mask a real deficiency somewhere else.
Then she moves to her separate parallel calculation, the reserve formula. She compares total customer credits against total customer debits.
And here is where the customer protection rule breaks down. Clueless Colin's account should represent a $100,000 credit, money the firm owes the customer. But the system only shows a $1,000 credit. Because the total credits are artificially low, the net excess that Fiona calculates is wrong.
And she doesn't put enough in the vault.
Exactly. As a result, she fails to deposit the required amount of cash into the special reserve bank account. The firm has now violated the core tenet of customer protection because the cash isn't locked in the vault.
And finally, Clueless Colin checks his mail. He receives his individual customer account statement, which, remember, is entirely separate from the firm's FOCIUS report.
Completely separate.
The carrying firm, who holds the ultimate regulatory liability under the carrying agreement, generated the statement based on the corrupted ledger.
Yep.
Colin opens the envelope, sees his balance is $99,000 short, and immediately files a massive complaint with the SEC.
As he should.
As he should.
Yeah.
So the regulators launch an investigation. They trace the missing money back to the reserve formula failure, back to the inaccurate FOCIUS report, back to the flawed general ledger. Who do the regulators hold accountable?
Well, they don't fine intern Iggy. Fair. They look at the carrying agreement to see who held the responsibility for safeguarding the funds and preparing the statements. The contract points to the massive carrying firm.
Okay.
Within that firm, the regulators look for the single point of ultimate accountability. They find Fiona the FENOP.
There she is.
Her supervisory systems failed to catch the ledger error, which corrupted the financial reports she had final responsibility for approving. Fiona faces the sanctions.
The butterfly effect. A single dropped zero in a local messy diary cascades into a massive federal compliance failure that lands squarely on the desk of the FENOP.
It's terrifying, honestly.
It is. But I want you, the listener, to keep that narrative in your head when you sit down for the Series 99. The rules in Function 1 aren't just isolated vocabulary words.
Right, they're not just flashcards.
Exactly. They are an interconnected ecosystem designed to prevent catastrophic failure. You can outsource the physical labor of printing a statement, but you can never outsource the liability of a broken system.
That is the perfect takeaway. If you understand how the pieces connect, you will not be tricked by the exam.
Understand the why and the what takes care of itself. We've covered the diaries, the report cards, the math, and the maps. Go ace that exam.